Okay, please be seated, everyone. Okay, we'll call our next case, which is case number 60254, Fernando Navarro Hernandez versus E.K. McDaniel. We have Mr. Pichetta representing the appellant, Mr. Owens representing the respondents. Mr. Pichetta, you may proceed. Did you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 5 minutes in case I need.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Michael Pichetta. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. I am representing Mr. Hernandez in this matter. All capital cases are different, but the case that you're seeing looks very much like many other capital cases that reach the court in this posture. We have a trial. Here are a capital case that went to trial 8 months after the offense, in which trial counsel does not fully investigate the case, and in particular the mitigation aspect of the penalty phase case. The jury imposes a death sentence. It's appealed. This court affirms the judgment of conviction and sentence. The case then goes to initial post-conviction proceedings in state court. Counsel appointed under the mandatory appointment provision also does not do any substantial investigation or expert analysis outside the record. And so habeas relief is denied. That's appealed to this court. This court affirms. The case then comes to us after the filing of a federal petition. We file an amended federal petition in which we do an investigation that we at least think was an adequate mitigation investigation of Mr. Hernandez's mental state and background. And we find a lot of evidence that no one has encountered before. Not this court, not the trial court, not the jury. We come back and we file a successive petition. And we attempt, under Crump versus Warden, to enforce the right to effective assistance of counsel in the post-conviction proceedings. And like pretty much every other case that this court has seen in this posture, we are entirely procedurally defaulted under every conceivable procedural default rule that anyone can think of. Now, Mr. Hernandez has some special problems that I'll allude to in a moment. But I think we have to look at this structurally and ask, how can this court accept the situation when what it leads to is essentially what we are told the law abhors, which is a right without a remedy? How is a capital habeas petitioner supposed to enforce his right to effective assistance of counsel in the initial post-conviction proceedings?
But how can we give you relief? We procedurally, every case that I've seen lately is procedural default, procedural default, procedural default. Why can't you get your relief in federal court? And then maybe they'll make us take a look at procedural default. Because it's very difficult for the seven of us to get our hands around this procedural default. I mean, it's an easy way to get rid of these cases as far as we're concerned, unfortunately.
Well, Your Honor, I hesitate to accept that characterization of what the court is doing. But I think it is time, and way past time, for this court, if it is going to adhere to Crump, to take this right seriously. And if you look at the structure that we have set up, it is clear that it can't work in the world that the district attorney's office exists in. Look at the rules that were imposed against us. The one-year rule of 34.726. Well, the one-year rule for a successive petition passed while Mr. Hernandez was being represented by initial post-conviction counsel. The five-year rule under 34.800 passed while Mr. Hernandez was being represented by initial post-conviction counsel. The successive petition bar of 34.810 is inherent in the fact that this is a successive petition that is seeking to enforce the right to effective assistance of counsel in the initial post-conviction. How can that be if, how can we say we are respecting the right under Crump if what we're saying is you can't enforce it? There is just no way to enforce it because you're going to be procedurally defaulted by the time you get in a position to do so. What I would like this court to do initially is to say, all right, what are we going to do? That issue is presented before the court in Ripo and in other cases. But there has got to be some recognition that if that's the construct, what we have is, in terms of the initial state post-conviction proceeding, it's not a means of enforcing the right to effective assistance of counsel at trial. It's a means of defaulting everything that the defense ever finds. I don't think that's what this court intends, but that's how it's turning out. And I think it's time for this court to take the responsibility of saying, no, we have to figure out what the rule is for enforcing this right. Now, the state has said, okay, well, this would have been timely, maybe. The state never really takes a position whether something would really be right. But if we had timed all of this from the end of the initial post-conviction proceeding in state district court, without taking an optional appeal. Well, let's walk through that idea. Post-conviction counsel would go to his or her client and say, okay, we've lost in the district court. You have a right to effective assistance of counsel in district court in this proceeding. So here are your choices. You can do an optional appeal and waive everything that I didn't raise. You can refuse to take an optional appeal and essentially waive every claim that I did raise, or I suppose you could file a successive habeas petition saying that I'm ineffective, even though you have no reason to know whether I'm ineffective or not at this point, and litigate that at the same time I'm litigating your habeas appeal. Does that make sense? It just doesn't. Okay, let's say we go through the habeas proceedings. It's the denial of relief is affirmed on appeal. There is no directly applicable rule as to what the time is, except even the state says it's a reasonable time. What's a reasonable time? All I know is that whatever we do, it's going to be wrong. If we filed it a month after, that wouldn't be reasonable. If we filed it 6 months after, that wouldn't be reasonable. If we file it a year after, which we have done in some cases, the state says that wasn't reasonable. Here we filed it within 17 months, and we alleged part of the problem in taking that long is that, lo and behold, one of Mr. Hernandez's problems is, in addition to being brain damaged and probably having fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, he's very paranoid. He's paranoid about us. And he is distrustful of us, and he is delusional in many areas. So it took us longer to get this petition on file. And I think it's sort of a res ipsa loquitur situation. What happened when we filed the state habeas petition, our successive state habeas petition, which we had to do without a verification from Mr. Hernandez? Mr. Hernandez moves to strike. He goes into the district court and he files a motion to strike our petition. Doesn't matter how many times we've said this is the only way we can get relief in federal court. This is the only way we can get these constitutional claims heard. He moves to strike on the ground that he thinks we are acting against him. And the only reason he verifies it is that the state joins in his motion to strike. And even Mr. Hernandez can appreciate that if the state is joining him in wanting to do something, they're trying to execute him. Maybe that means he should do the opposite. That doesn't mean he trusts us. He still does not trust us. We do the best we can. We follow the provisions of Rule of Professional Conduct 1.14, but we are never going to get him to trust us. All we can do is what we can with him, which in this case was filing an unverified petition, which then he decided to verify. Now, 17 months to do an investigation and put together a state exhaustion petition on a 10-year-old case, more than a 10-year-old case, in which nobody had done any investigation in Mexico, where he grew up, where he was put in a mental institution as a child, where he was so obviously off that the other children called him Martian. Doing an investigation of mitigation in Mexico is no joke. 17 months does not seem unreasonable. But we did not get a hearing to explain that. We did not get a hearing on any sort of any of the procedural default issues. And we told the district court, and you can look at 22 Appellant's Appendix 5439, we argued to the district court, look, the problem is he's mentally ill. He doesn't understand we are trying to help him, and that has been the impediment. In fact, I think the way it was phrased in this argument was he's his own impediment. His mental illness is the impediment. Whatever this court decides in this particular case, at some point, I submit respectfully, you have to come to the grips with the fact that if you say, okay, the jury didn't hear Mr. Hernandez is mentally ill, this court, when you struck an aggravating factor that was improperly applied and said, well, there's not much mitigation here, so it was harmless, improper aggravating factor, wouldn't you have liked to know that he's delusional, that he was put in a mental institution as a child, that he has brain damage? And what we are going to end up with is exactly what the United States Supreme Court said was a problem and a bad thing to be avoided, which is that no one will ever review the merits of that claim, of that claim of ineffectiveness.
Mr. Bissett, do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
I think I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Mr. Owens.
May it please the Court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office for Respondent. About 13 years ago, Michael Pichette, on behalf of the Federal Public Defender's Office, stood before this court in the Pellegrini case. And he was told in a unanimous published opinion from this court at that time that although Crump permits a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel as good cause, it is only good cause as to the successive petition bar of 34.810, and that such a claim would still have to satisfy the timeliness requirement of the one-year time bar, 34.726, which the legislature enacted and says that a petitioner must show good cause for the delay in filing a petition. In 34.726, gave guidance that the delay must not be the fault of the petitioner. And from that, this court has said that it must be something external to the defense that causes the delay in coming here back to this court to raise a claim. Rather than comply with that ruling, the Federal Public Defender's Office has continued to delay on successive petitions, continue to drag proceedings out. This case is somewhat less egregious than others, where it's been 5, 6, 7 years that they've spent litigating claims in federal court. Here, it's a matter of 17 months if you look at the date from when the remitterer issued from the denial of the post-conviction appeal by this court. We're looking at a time frame of 17 months where they did not have any court proceeding pending before they filed where? In state court? No, they filed in federal court in September of 2009, and then finally, after 17 months, got back to this court. So there is a timeliness component. There are examples of cases on successive petitions that come back in a timely manner to allege ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, and we reach the merits of those claims. Unfortunately, there's not many from the Federal Public Defender's Office because they continue to delay. They are so successful in the delay game that they have effectively brought executions to a halt in the state of Nevada now for many years. They are so effective in the delay tactics that when their own client says, you know what, I'm comfortable with what claims I already have here in federal court. My strongest claims are already here. I don't want to waste the 5 to 10 years it's going to take to go back to exhaust some other claims that aren't as important to me. I'd rather be able to move forward and get vindicated on my constitutional claims already in federal court. What do? They call their client incompetent. They call their client too mentally ill to make decisions like that on their own. And that's why this defendant disavowed the petition that they filed on his behalf. If you look at the pro per motion, Mr. Hernandez is anything but incompetent. His briefs are much more intelligible to me than some of the federal public defender's briefs. He knew full well what he wanted to do strategically to pursue his litigation, and it did not involve coming back here to exhaust state claims. Now, they did talk him back around, and he did eventually verify the petition that they had prematurely filed on his behalf, and we went forward to litigate those claims. This, to me, is a fairly easy case. It presents, because we have the 17-month delay from remitterer from the denial of the post-conviction appeal, and I'm not buying for a minute that that is the significant date from which some new one-year time frame moves forward. Well, there's one-year time bar, and that extends from remitter from direct appeal. And that issued in 2003, and so any petition filed after March 10th of 2004 is in default under the one-year time bar and must show good cause external to the defense, some impediment by the government that prevented them from filing a claim. The ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim itself just gets them past the successive petition bar. They've got to show good cause for all of this other time when they were pursuing their federal relief. Years ago, this court in the Coley case said pursuit of federal habeas proceedings is not good cause to delay coming back to state court. They say in their petition here that they needed to investigate the claims. They needed to go down to Mexico. And even though the defendant's own brother was here locally and testified in the penalty hearing, testified at trial for the defense, they wanted to go clear back to Mexico. The defendant had immigrated from Mexico when he was age 16. They wanted to go back and do this exhaustive kind of investigation. And they said that's why they delayed. The investigation is not necessary to file a petition. Our legislature has made it very, very easy to come back. Any criminal defendant on his own without counsel can file a petition. In fact, Mr. Hernandez is the one who filed his pro per petition on March 12, 2003 for his first post-conviction petition, and he filed it within 2 days of issuance of remitter from direct appeal. Did he have, he would have that one-year time bar. He could have taken his time for a year and investigated and still been timely, but he filed it within 2 days. And then he proceeded to ask for counsel and say, you know what, I want to allege ineffective assistance of trial counsel and appellate counsel, and this is a complicated case. Please appoint me counsel who can come in and file a supplemental petition, and we will investigate this, and I will file a supplemental brief as I develop my claims within the context of the state habeas proceeding. And that's how that went forward. Why should a successive habeas proceeding be any different? And yet it is. It's not the pro per defendants that are coming back right immediately after the first round of post-conviction in state court. It's not them who are coming back and filing a pro per petition asking for appointment of counsel. It's the federal public defender coming back after they've already spent considerable time in federal court taking advantage of lenient discovery rules to develop their claims before they want to come and then dump it all back on the state court after many years. There's nothing to prevent the defendant from filing a pro per successive petition saying, you know what, I want to allege the ineffective assistance of my post-conviction counsel. I need time to, I'd like to get an attorney for that purpose. I'm going to need time to file a supplemental claim. I'd like to conduct some discovery. I'd like to get the file. I'd like to read it all and then file a supplement, and that can happen. That's what the state proceedings are there for. It's not there for you to do all that investigation and discovery outside of the state process and then try to claim that as your good cause for why you finally got around to returning. Because then we have situations like in other cases where it took them 5, 6, 7 years to complete their investigation, to finally get the facts and claims together that they claimed that they needed to return to state court and file the petition. Legislature came up with an easy-to-fill-out form for any petitioner to just file that. This is not a case where we need to go look at, how soon must they return to state court? Because here, even looking at 17 months, even if we use the remitter date from the appeal, 17 months, the legislature said, you know, for an initial petition, you only get 12 months. Why would they get 17 on a successive petition before they come back? I think clearly, and that's the argument I've been making, anything that fell outside of 1 year, not that I agree with that, but just going with the flow saying we can dismiss a lot of these cases on procedural bars if they took more than a year to come back, per se, that's got to be unreasonable, because first post-conviction defendants don't get that. The legislature felt that at the outside was the maximum. And so that's the argument I've been making, is at the outside, 1 year is about all that could possibly be reasonable. But in appropriate cases, and this isn't one, where they got back before a year, I make the additional argument that, all you need is 2 days. You need 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, because you know you're going to file a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. That's what a successive petition is for. That's what the first petition was for, to allege ineffective assistance of trial counsel. You didn't need to know all the minutia and have done all the discovery in order to return in a timely fashion. Their arguments of good cause are the defendant's incompetence and mental illness, and that he wanted to go a different way strategically with his own case, and they wouldn't let him. Yet this court has not held that a defendant has to be competent for an initial post-conviction petition, let alone a successive habeas petition. And certainly his mental illness is nothing that is external to the defense. The government isn't responsible for any disagreements between the federal public defender and their client, arguing about how and when strategically they should file a petition and in what court. So the incompetence cannot constitute good cause, and this court is so held in the Phelps case. The investigation, as I've already addressed, they can do that within the context of the state proceeding after they file their petition. They claim that they were waiting on the file. They need time to gather that file. Long ago in Hood, this court said, you don't need the file to file a post-conviction habeas proceeding because it's a short form, fill in the blank, file the thing, and then get the file later and file a supplement. This court's very liberal and very generous with construing the rules about supplements. The legislature intended 30 days for the filing of a supplemental petition by counsel. And yet this court, over my objection, has said that you can file multiple supplements many years after your initial petition, including even after an evidentiary hearing, and expand way beyond the claims that had initially proceeded. That's another delay problem for another day, but this court has interpreted those statutes very liberally, that they are given wide latitude to file a supplement as they develop the new claims. And so what is a reasonable time is not a question that needs to be answered in this case. Clearly 17 months from remitter, 17 months when they were discussing strategies and then filing in federal court before they come back, that certainly is, because it's well beyond 1 year, we can say that that is per se unreasonable. That's what the judge in this case did. She didn't reach the merits of first post-conviction counsel's performance, didn't get into the merits of the things that trial counsel did do, and the experts that they did consult, and how those experts disagree with the new experts that the federal public defender has gotten many years later. This was denied based on the federal public defender's failure to show good cause to explain that period of time for which no proceeding was pending in any court anywhere, or during which the time that the federal petition was pending and they litigated their claims there. That's an election of remedies. There's nothing about the federal habeas rules that would bar a defendant from filing a petition in state court timely to raise those claims here. They elected a different form. They wanted to pursue their claims in federal court to the exclusion of their state remedies, and it's only when they're get well into the federal proceedings that they and facing a motion to dismiss because they've included unexhausted claims that they get around to saying, all right, well, we'll go back and we'll exhaust those. And we've seen how that delay game plays out. Maybe not in this case, because this is just the second time they've come back, but we've seen them in capital cases come back 3-4 times. Our state bars operate independently of the federal courts, and they operate better than the federal courts. The legislature didn't contemplate that here some 14 years later, after the commission of this crime, after the verdict and sentence of death, that we'd still be here in state court talking about claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. These cases need to move faster through the system. There's no reason that they can't. We can still be thorough. We can still do the investigation. But we need to listen to the legislature and the procedural bars that they have enacted and give meaning and effect to them and stop the delay tactics.
Concludes my remarks. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for Mr. Owens? Thank you, Mr. Owens. Mr. Pichetta.
If we were happy, just half as powerful as counsel suggests we are, I would feel a lot better.
Well, I was going to congratulate you, Mr. Pichetta, because since 1976, 12 people have been executed in the state, and 11 of them committed judicial suicide, where they fought to be killed. So I think you've done a good job, according to Mr. Owens. I join in what he says. Great job, Mr. Pichetta. Great job, federal public defender, special public defender, murder teams on the Clark County public defender and the Washoe public defender, et cetera.
Well, thank you, I think, Your Honor.
Well, thank Mr. Owens. He's the one who said it.
But let me
I'm just agreeing with the DA for change.
That there is a delay. Whom does that hurt? Hurts us. This case was pending in the initial state habeas proceeding and the appeal from that for 6 years. If we had had 6 years to investigate this, we would have been in great shape to come in the day after a remitter issued in the initial proceeding and file this petition, and we would have been in fine shape. That's not how the system works. We do not get a case until somebody files something in federal court. Mr. Hernandez, after the remitter issued on the initial habeas appeal, he started filing motions to get the file and to get this and to get DNA testing. And what did he get from counsel? He got the back of his hand. They opposed every single thing he filed except the motion to substitute, to remove previous counsel. When it comes to us, we haven't been sitting around twiddling our thumbs with this case for 6 years. We get the case, and we have to start sprinting because the ADPA deadline in federal court is 1 year, and we got it filed in federal court by that time. This is not an election of remedies. If we don't file something in federal court by that time, he gets no federal review, period. And Mr. Owens has argued in other cases that until we file that and until we get a stay in abeyance order from the federal court, we can't even come back to state court. It's this court's responsibility, I submit, with all respect. If you are going to say Crump is the law, there has to be a remedy that does not expire before the defendant can exercise it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michetta. Mr. Owens, thank you, as always, for your excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission.